verdad, mentira, lo que cuece bajo la oscuridad. Mentira el amor, mentira el sabor, mentira la que manda, mentira comanda.
Welcome to the Bread and Roses Show here on Valley Free Radio, WXOJ 103.3 FM, streaming at valleyfreeradio.org. I'm Joel Sachs. Here at Bread and Roses, we talk about a range of issues related to creating a fair economy and social justice. On today's show, we replay an interview done in August 2014 with Joe Gannon on the publication of his first novel, Night of the Jaguar, a detective mystery set in 1980s Nicaragua, not long after the Sandinista Revolution, following the travails of a former heroic military commander, now turned homicide investigator. Published by Minotaur Books, an imprint of St. Martin's Press, we're replaying the interview to celebrate a series of awards the book has won, including the American Library Association's magazine book list naming Night of the Jaguar the best mystery debut of 2014. Most recently, the book won second place honors at the International Latino Book Awards in the mystery category, an honor further embellished by the fact that first place went to the renowned author Isabel Allende. Joe Gannon is a world-class journalist, long-term public school language arts teacher with teaching stints around the globe, and spoken word artist as well as being a former Bread and Roses co-host. Joe has just finished the second novel in the Ajax Montoya series, named The Last Dawn, which will be published this fall. He is joined in this interview by his daughter Val, herself a budding cultural critic. Night of the Jaguar.
Night of the Jaguar.
By Mr. Joe Gannon. And let me read, this is from the Amazon site, which it looks like you're getting some very good press.
Yeah.
The Amazon page here, Joe Gannon, writer, teacher, set dresser, editor, and spoken word artist, has been a freelance journalist in Nicaragua during the Sandinista Revolution, writing for the Christian Science Monitor, the Toronto Globe and Mail, and the San Francisco Examiner. Since then, his writing has appeared in the Los Angeles Times, the Independent, the London Daily, the Valley Advocate, and Daily Hampshire Gazette. Joe spent 3 years in the Army, graduated from UMass Amherst, received his MFA at Pine Manor College. After a stint teaching in Abu Dhabi, which we've heard about on an earlier show when you got back, Mr. Joe Gannon is now working on his second novel, the next in the Ajax Montoya series.
Ajax Montoya.
So who is Ajax Montoya?
Well, Captain Ajax Montoya is, when we meet him in the story, he's a captain in the Sandinista police, in the Policia Sandinista. He's a homicide detective, but in a country like Nicaragua, it means essentially he is the entire homicide bureau. It's set in 1986, so during the Sandinista Revolution, you know, Reagan is in power. People forget that other than the Soviet Union and nuclear apocalypse, I mean, most of the headlines in the 80s had to do with Nicaragua, El Salvador, Central America. People forget about that. So Ajax had been a hero of the revolution, the fight against Somoza, who I only refer to as the ogre in the book. And he was famous. He was kind of a rock star of the Revo. But then peace comes, and he doesn't, as many, you know, happens with like rebels, with guerrillas, you know. He doesn't make the transition to peacetime very well, like a lot of combat veterans don't. He marries another rock star of the revolution, but eventually he drifts away from politics, drifts away from his old comrades, and falls into the bottle. So he goes on a bender for several years. He's a drunk, and he's pretty much worn out his welcome in terms of, or not his welcome, but he's worn out all the slack everyone wants to give him because of what he did during the revolution. So when we first meet him, he's 6 days sober and losing his mind. He's having hallucinations and is given over to fits. So when this corpse turns up in Managua, and the thesaurus, right?
What is that, Val? By the way, Val is Joe's budding daughter, who is a brilliant young intellectual in her own right.
And my copy editor right now for the second book.
Copy editor.
Yeah. What about the thesaurus?
So, yeah, yeah. What about, what's your take on this? What role did you have? As you saw your father writing this, what are the ways in which you may have participated in the process? Anything, any comments you made or suggestions?
Well, one of the clues in the book happened because I commanded him to somehow involve a sock monkey.
A sock monkey.
Yes, her door, a sock monkey.
Yeah.
And it wound up becoming, not a sock monkey, but a different kind of child's toy. It winds up becoming one of the essential clues. But no, Val's read all of the second novel. She's a very good copy editor, actually.
Wow.
And when you go through a series of edits with the publisher, and the last one they sent you, it almost seems silly. They sent me his big, fat manuscript all printed out, and I had to handwrite corrections in colored pencil only. And Val had made a comment about something that I had read when you first meet the villain. And I, based upon what she said, I actually rewrote in my colored pencil, you know, like I was a five-year-old. But I rewrote this one scene.
I use colored pencils.
Based on, I know, but I mean, I'm, you know, at least 40 now, and I'm still using colored pencils.
Give us a little bit about where you were that informed you of this. You were a journalist in Nicaragua during this period.
Yes. During the 80s, I was there for several years. I'd been a editor at a small third world news agency in New York. And a friend of mine had left just as I was leaving. I took his job, and he'd gone to Nicaragua. So 3 years in the basement office of the UN building, editing other people's copies. I was going
this
crazy.
This is in New York.
This is in New York,
so
yeah.
You were in your early 20s, mid-20s.
Oh, yeah, right out of college, really.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I just went, got really like, there was a people might remember the People Powers Revolution in the Philippines that overthrew Marcos. It was one of the first great, you know, beginnings of the whole system of the 20th century beginning to crack that then fed into the fall of communism and the rest of it. Anyways, there was a guy sending in copy. He was right there, man. He was right there seeing the People Powers Revolution. It was everywhere on television. People couldn't believe it.
In the Philippines.
He was in Manila, yeah.
Manila.
Sending this copy back, terrible copy, but I spent hours piecing together and rewriting. And one day I thought, man, I could do better than this. So I decided I had to get out. I'd been to Nicaragua once already. People have forgotten, I said this, I think, before the show, that it was a huge part of our foreign policy back then, the amount of ink in the newspapers, the effort and the energy that went into fighting the Sandinistas in Nicaragua and shoring up this right-wing death squad government in El Salvador after the Soviet Union and nuclear annihilation. These were like two of the biggest issues of the entire 1980s as far as American foreign policy goes. So I chose Nicaragua. I had a friend there already, and he just happened to be leaving Nicaragua when I got there. So I picked up a couple of strings, writing mostly at the beginning about economics, development news, finance, that kind of thing, because all the
and
political...
So this was when the Sandinistas were in power.
These were the early years. 1987.
When did they actually take power?
The revolution triumphed in 1979, so mm-hmm. about 50 years of dynastic dictatorship was overthrown. This is one of the cruelest, you know, guys in one of the largest armies as well. So they were in power from 1979
who were completely backed by the United States.
Oh, yes. Yeah. There's a famous, I don't know if I can say son of a bitch on the radio. Is that allowed?
I'm not sure what the seven words are, but...
There's a famous phrase about that. You know, he might be a son of a bitch, but at least he's our son of a bitch. Mm. Well, the phrase was invented to describe the first Somoza ruling Nicaragua. And it was supposedly a quip from FDR. People were talking about Somoza and like, yeah, he's a son of a bitch, but at least he's our son of a bitch. So we had backed him for years. Because the Marines had been in Nicaragua in the 1920s and 30s for almost 10 years fighting Sandino.
Sandino,
where the Sandinistas took the name from. He ran him ragged. So instead of defeating him, and this might sound familiar, they invited him to a peace treaty where he signed a peace treaty and then he was assassinated. And the first Somoza took over. So that was about 50 years of dictatorship in 1979. The Sandinistas, the revolution then, was there from 79 to 1990. Where they stood in their second election and lost. And for the first time, maybe certainly in Nicaraguan history, perhaps in the world, a revolutionary government that came through power through force of arms surrendered power after they lost an election. So the book is set in the middle of all that, 1986. So Reagan is president, the Contra Army that Reagan and the CIA, the American government developed and funded is still very much a power. Many people won't remember Iran-Contra anymore, the illegality that went into trying to fund this.
Contragate, right?
That was Contragate, yeah. Irangate, I think it was also known as. Where they were selling weapons to the Ayatollahs in Iran and taking the profits to fund the Contra whip. So that all takes place, and as part of the background, the murder that takes place, this guy who's pretty much on his last legs, you know, he's possibly insane.
Ajax Montoya.
Captain Ajax Montoya. So this murder that turns up begins to link all of these things together. The Cold War, what's going on with the Contra War. So this guy who's let himself be kind of shuffled into the background suddenly becomes very much front and center because of this this murder that takes place. So it's about a guy trying to really maintain the last bits of his soul that he has left. And while that's going on, you know, the world is getting ready to be set on fire all around him.
How does the novel deal with his own, the personal character, his conflicts, and the political situation that's going on?
That was one of my biggest struggles, Joe. I mean, I was getting an MFA at the time at Pine Manor College. And, you know, I was worried about that. People don't know Nicaragua, or they don't care. So at one point, I was working with a professor named Randall Keenan, who's a wonderful writer. He teaches down in North Carolina. And he wrote on this 20 pages I sent him. He said, "You stop your book for 5 pages and give a history lesson on Nicaragua. This is a crime against humanity. Don't ever do this again."
That was
his feedback. He thought to stop and give this history lesson. So in order to make the history and the politics work, they have to kind of go to the background. I mean, they have to be linked. Nothing political happens that is not linked to the personal in one of the characters. And that's how you bring it to life. People may not remember, or they may not care about it, but if I make them care enough about this guy, who's your kind of classic tortured soul, and everything that occurs, you see through the prism of his, you know, consciousness. So his lack of, I mean, he's a man who's literally not sure that he can live long enough or stay sane long enough to figure out, you know, what the hell is going on.
So this period in Nicaragua, they're trying to build the revolution, build people's power, build people's organizations. The little that I know, I've read about the efforts to give people land reform, to give people some stake in the society, which you were witnessing, right? Is that woven in there? And then the way
I wanted to deal with the country as it was. Having lived there for 3 years myself, but also dealing it with from an insider's point of view. Everything you say is correct, but that's kind of a, forgive me, Joe, but it's kind of like a journalistic summary. To Ajax, as Ajax says in the book at one point, he's at literally at daggers drawn with his ex-wife, who he still loves a little bit, but also his best friend and mentor, the guy who brought him into the Sandinistas, the guy who taught him everything that he knows. And they explained to him that, look, I mean, he wants justice to be served because of this murder. This guy was a citizen of the Republic. He gave 3 sons to the revolution. You know, this other person killed him. You know, I want justice to happen. And they point out, in the larger context of the war with America, it's not going to happen. You make justice happen in this one case, and you're going to bring a world of misery down on everybody, and you're not going to do that. So they kind of get into a conversation about, this is not what I fought for all those years, because I use a couple of the memoirs from Sandinista fighters at the time, and it was an absolutely miserable existence in the mountains trying to defeat Somoza. So at one point, he's like, I didn't do everything I did just for this Cold War chess game. And his wife is ex-wife is angry at him and says, "Well, what did you fight for?" And his response is, "Flu shots and flush toilets." And this is what he fought for. and it's not happening for any number of reasons. There's an ongoing joke in the story about the Soviet Union. Nicaragua survived, as was the case with Cuba, you know, on these freighters that would come from the Soviet Union. So the supermarkets, when I lived there, would be empty of everything until a Soviet freighter came. It might bring only light bulbs, but then there would be light bulbs everywhere. If the Soviet oil tanker was late a few days, the country literally ran out of gas. I mean, that was it. There wasn't any. So the it would just empty out. The streets would be eerily empty. So Ajax does not, you know, think much of the Soviet Union. He's not an ideologue. That's part of his problem, like post-war, was, you know, having to deal with the political alliances you need to survive at that time. So he has a, I mean, he's also a detective, don't forget. I mean, he's got a very jaded perspective on everything except justice, as I think the best, you know, detectives always do. So that there, what the revolution wished to do and failed to do and wanted to do but did pretty well is all there. But all of it is, like I said, it's all, there's a phrase that's called, it says exposition as ammunition. So anytime you're trying to explain something expository in a book, it's got to be ammunition from one character or another that they're using to beat someone up with. So they do go over that, but it might be in this case, it's in a, the scene is a fight between, you know, a man and his ex-wife that he's still a little bit in love with. So those things are all discussed, but it's in the context of these two people having this hellacious fight.
You're listening to the Bread and Roses Show on Valley Free Radio, WXOJ 103.3 FM, streaming at valleyfreeradio.org. I'm Joel Sachs. We're replaying an interview done in August 2014 with Joe Gannon on the publication of his first novel, Night of the Jaguar, a detective mystery set in 1980s Nicaragua. We're replaying the show to celebrate varied awards the book has won in the past year, including most recently second place honors at the International Latino Book Awards in the mystery category, and has been named by the American Library Association's magazine the best mystery debut of 2014. Joe has just finished the second novel in the Ajax Montoya series, The Last Dawn, which will be published this fall. Val, tell us what you have a book in front of you. Tell us a little bit about your current, your father's telling about the book that he's recently written. Tell us about the book that you're recently reading. What's here to share?
Well, it's called Kamikaze Kaito Jian by Irina Tanimura. It's a graphic novel.
Graphic novel. And what, can you tell us a little bit about the story?
Well, it's about this girl who at night she turns into a phantom thief and exercises paintings with demons inside them and stuff.
She exercises the demons out of paintings?
Yes.
That's
wow.
Cool.
Wow. And tell us a little bit for those people who don't know what this particular style, because there's all kinds of graphic novels. What was the term you used for this?
Manga.
Manga. Manga. What is that?
It's a type of Japanese graphic novel. Particular style. And
for anybody who hasn't seen it, who's not familiar, can you tell us anything, like what it looks like, what the form itself? If you were describing this to somebody who'd never seen it, what grabs you about this? What's interesting or?
Well, I like the art style in it. It's kind of an anime style.
And what is anime?
A type of Japanese animation, the kind with giant eyes.
We used to call them cartoons back in the day, but now it's anime.
But there's something specific, I think. I need to do my own research and find out. They are cartoons, but are they distinct in their genre, anime, or is it just the Japanese term for it?
A large, sparkling eyes. And
but do you think, Val, there is like a particular art style?
Are you wearing,
style?
Is your yeah. shirt also?
Oh,
it
yes.
looks like an anime mm-hmm. character.
Yeah.
Who is that?
Death the Kid from Soul Eater.
So this is something you have been reading and enjoying.
Yes.
For a little while.
Obsessing over. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, that's definitely a thing. Now, I've learned about it as well because I've been looking at them. But there's definitely a particular artistic style, Joel, to the anime. The big eyes that she's talking about. I told her that when we were kids, you might remember a cartoon called Speed Racer from like a long time ago. It was the first Japanese anime crossover. And that was when I was a child. So manga is the book version, though, Val, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Are there any cartoon artists that do moving picture animation that you would suggest if somebody like myself wanted to learn more about it? Are there any comic cartoonists that are doing movies that animation artists, moving pictures, that you might recommend? Anything that you favor?
Got a favorite artist?
Like cartoons, you know, that you can call up on Netflix or something?
Well, I particularly like Full Metal Alchemist and Full Metal Alchemist Brotherhood.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. I'm going to write that down. And
that's a particular show.
Full Metal Alchemist.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
But we went into Comic-Con, the big convention in Boston, a couple weeks ago as well. At where Val was, if I can talk about this, yeah, the cosplay. It's called cosplay. Is one of the side effects of anime and the mangas and everyone loving it. So it's when
so
you dress
fun.
Up as a costume. So Val was dressed as one of the characters from the show she was
Lieutenant
talking about.
Lieutenant
Risa Hawkeye from Full Metal Alchemist. And she'd bought some of the outfit in California. We had made a couple of other bits to finish it at home. And by God, Joel, we get there. And within a few minutes, someone's like, hey, are you Risa Hawkeye? Can I take your picture? And I was like, people were coming up to her and like recognizing her. And there was, at one point, I look over, she's 11 now. And there's this group of young men. They must have been 18, 19, you know. They're like, oh, is it Risa Hawkeye? And they're all getting busy, like taking her picture. So I'm trying to get a picture of these boys surrounding Val so they can get their picture taken with her character, Risa Hawkeye.
I think, you know, we're gonna get back to Joe's book and the history of Nicaragua and some poetry. But the next time we're here, we talked about you coming in and hosting a show on popular culture. So I think this could be a topic that we really. I was down in South Beach, and there was a Comic-Con convention
right.
down there. Huge, yeah. huge. Sitting on Lincoln Road, and the streams of people in all kinds of costumes who were there was incredible, and it just piqued my interest. I know a little bit about fandom, but so the next time we're here, is that okay? Can we do a show that's kind of dedicated, at least in part, to what that whole phenomena is of Comic-Con?
She's got, yes, I mean, Val could certainly speak on it. She's well-versed in it because it goes from the gamut from, like, Doctor Who to through The Matrix, that kind of sci-fi, into
like
the anime and manga. Of course you do. What kind of
There's a new Doctor Who coming out.
Yeah, this Sunday,
that?
Man.
Yeah.
You kidding?
Yeah. Is that on PBS? Is that on?
Get our stuff from Pirate Bay. But eventually it will be on local television.
Totally not legal.
That is totally legal, actually. Pirate Bay is a perfectly legal organization.
What is that?
Then why'd you get blocked?
Pirate Bay is just a place where you can download things.
Okay.
And people
Pirate
call
Bay.
It, it's called Pirate Bay on purpose. But because you download fragments from hundreds or thousands of computers, you're not actually pirating. It's been proven.
Then why'd it get blocked on your computer?
I don't think it did. I've ever seen it blocked, unless you're in the wrong place or something. But no, it didn't get blocked for that reason. So, Doctor Who is back out again.
Yeah. So to go back to Nicaragua,
yes.
And I'm torn here. We have we have another half hour, but I want to honor and respect you as a writer and what the work of that novel was, but also my interest in part of the socialist project as it's evolved in our time, and you were there, and when you first came back to town, you wrote a piece in the Daily Hampshire Gazette about Cuba, your experiences in Cuba. And what I've always respected about you is how much you you really say you don't stick to the typical left line. You're very honest and kind of a libertarian leftist in a way of I don't want to use any terms to characterize you, but
here's the one I made up. I'm a Brechtian populist.
Oh, cool. Yeah. So you shatter.
My manifesto comes from a poem by Bertolt Brecht called The Song of the Water Wheel.
Your magnetic memory, can you give us a little bit of that?
The core or the refrain is yes, the wheel is the song of the water wheel. So it's talking about, like, the metaphor is how humanity is like this water wheel. Doesn't matter who's on top. The water wheel has to make the water go round. The water wheel are the rulers. Doesn't matter, like he says, we've had so many masters, swine or eagle, lean or fat one. Some were tigers, some hyenas. Still we fed this one and that one. And whether one is better than the other, one boot is always like another when it treads upon you. What I say about them is we need no other masters. We can do without them. And Brecht,
That was Joe Gannon. That's there's no book in front of. I just want you to know this man. What is in the reserves there are tremendous.
But it's my political manifesto. I had to have it, in hand. And Brecht, of course, was an anti-Stalinist communist. He went back to East Germany. But so just that notion of, it doesn't matter left or right, up or down, with the water wheel. It's the water, as he says, it's the water underneath fares badly, for it has to make the wheel go round. So
the challenge of in Nicaragua, Ortega is back in power and has become his own kind of Caudillo, is that the word?
Presidente por vida.
A strong man in his own, yes. In the mold of other... Other
he's
Latin
gone,
American
he's gone
or Chavez,
bit, yeah.
but I don't know enough about Venezuela to really talk, but a kind of authoritarian populist with some perhaps leanings, but the question of what happened to the revolution in Nicaragua, can you speak just what you see?
Well, what happened, Joel, was my friend Gioconda Belli is one of the great living poets of Nicaragua. She wrote this piece, or maybe we were just talking one night. But she had said that the tragedy of Nicaragua was that, it was in some ways, Joel, the last battle of the Cold War. The Sandinistas come to power in 79. Reagan is elected in 80. Margaret Thatcher is prime minister in England. Everybody thought this stuff would go on forever. But by 1985, Gorbachev is in power. The Soviet Union is starting to unravel. Their own misadventure, their bloody misadventure in Afghanistan has sapped them of, people and resources.
Echoes, right?
Echoes indeed, yeah. So in that sense, it was a tragedy because by the mid-80s, and yet everyone played out the roles like it was the 1950s. What the Sandinistas did wrong was they came to power through an armed insurrection and then clung to the Marxist-Leninist line. And in a world divided into two superpowers, they chose sides, and they chose one of the superpowers. There is a third world non-aligned movement that was trying to get by. But back then... the hostility that they expected to come from the United States, and which, of course, came from the United States, pushed them to align themselves with the Soviet Union. They needed the cash. They needed the oil.
I mean, did they really? This is the same story of Cuba. It's not that different.
Yes, but again, it worked out as badly in Cuba as it did eventually, only a much shorter period in Nicaragua. Because, having lived abroad, I don't take away people's... sovereignty. So the notion that the United States made them, no. Joel, these are guys and women who came to power and they made a calculated decision. The same way Fidel and Che and Raul made certain decisions as well. The point is, no one foresaw the collapse of the Soviet Union, so they could have gone on being a Soviet client as long as Cuba did. But part of Ajax's and my character's objection to what's going on is that he did not fight this war just to become a client of the Soviet Union and the imports. That the Soviet Union, in fact, I can't quite say, but he's given a little lecture to this new lieutenant who he picks up. It's kind of his sidekick, but she's really been put with him to spy on him. And he says, look, the world, the world is run by a two-headed monster. One is an eagle and the other one is a bear, and it doesn't matter which one tears you up because they all poop out the same butthole, which is maybe not the way he puts it, but, and that's a metaphor. I also got an image I got from Carlos Fuentes, the great Mexican novelist. So what happened in Nicaragua is everyone played their role. So, and it's just also the worst kind of timing that it would be Reagan, the cowboy president, determined to, you know, take on the Soviets, which he couldn't do. You know, he was striking his big wheat deals with Russia, but he could take it out on Nicaragua. And the terrible thing about the Contra War and the counter-revolutionary army that Reagan and the CIA created was its only task and its only possibility for success was to drain that already poor country, to further impoverish about the poorest country in the hemisphere anyways. And that's what they did. They stood on his back.
So it still is the case next to Haiti, right? Nicaragua is the second poorest country.
I mean, I was there actually last about a year ago. So it's changed tremendously since the Sandinistas and since the revolution. But it just means that it's become like so much else in the world where you've got the 1% have been able to build all of their Starbucks and make the place look a lot better than it ever did when I lived there.
Well, Managua,
it's still a crushingly poor place.
I mean, Managua looks like Hialeah. You know, you drive through Managua, and I kept pinching myself. I couldn't figure out whether I was in Little Havana or Managua. Just, you know, the auto shops, you know, the light
very
industry, you know, and just the strip.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, am I in Hialeah here?
Right.
You know, for people who don't know, Hialeah is a completely Latin, one of the many metropolitan municipalities in South Florida, Dade County. And I was like, where am I?
Yeah. You know? So it's changed, I mean, in that sense, but it's still one of the poorest countries. So then you had this, which I take up in the book, Joel. You know, the Central American Peace Plan was an incredible thing that occurred.
What is that?
Well, in 1986, the president of Costa Rica, Oscar Arias, who later went on to win a Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts, they understood that the Contra Army created by the United States, which was mostly, don't forget, not in Nicaragua, was on the borders in Honduras and Costa Rica. It was getting larger than the armies of some nations in Central America. And they knew that Reagan, this was in 1986, 2 years before Reagan is gone, they know that America has the attention span of a child and eventually would move off to pull the wings off of some other fly. And what would happen with these 10,000 heavily armed, well-financed, and well-trained Contra soldiers? So it was kind of a tacit agreement amongst the presidents of Central America that that army had to be neutralized and it had to be gotten rid of before Reagan left. So they came together not out of solidarity, not out of any anti-imperialist notion, but by understanding that the greatest destabilizing factor in Central America was not the right-wing death squad, the left-wing rebels. It was this Contra army created by the United States. So the peace plan was, we will all sign this. You'll make some changes. We'll make some changes. But the big agreement was on no cross-border or transnational rebel groups. So the Salvadoran leftists, the FMLN, had to stay in El Salvador, which it was anyways. The Sandinistas had to stop supporting them, which they weren't doing that much anyways. But the whole thing really was about, therefore, the Contra had to go back to Nicaragua, where they could not survive. So it compelled them to sign a peace treaty with the Sandinistas in 1989, which they did. That led about 18 months later to a peace treaty in El Salvador, and then finally in Guatemala. And all of these peace treaties didn't end the social conflicts, the terrible social conflicts, the horrendous slaughter that took place in the Central American Civil Wars in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Nicaragua during the 1980s. Didn't change anything. It just brought it all to a halt, which is some kind of a victory for humanity anyways. But part of that was then you had to stand in these free and fair elections. So the Sandinista government agreed to stand in an election instead of 92 to move it up to 1990. They stood in the election and then they lost. The otherwise fractured and virtually useless opposition in Nicaragua all came together. They united behind this one well-known woman, a newspaper publisher, Violeta Chamorro, whose husband had been famously assassinated by Somoza. He was one of the great martyrs of the revolution. And as the United States knew that a Sandinista victory would only lead to more degradation, more war, more sanctions, And also because of the mistakes the Sandinistas made, they had this really draconian military draft that people were just sick of. But they didn't change anything. They didn't change their Soviet-imported economic policies. They didn't get rid of the draft. And they lost. soundly defeated. But then, of course, they wind up being... And then, of course, the opposition wins. It takes them 5 minutes to fracture. So now, in the other levels of government, the judiciary or the legislative, you have this one huge unified bloc of Sandinistas who are angry that they lost this election. And then this fractured... opposition. So what it did was get the Sandinistas out of power, for sure. But then it also just ruined the country because you had this fractured opposition, a unified, which is now the government, but you had this fractures in the government. You had a unified opposition in the Sandinistas who didn't let anything get done. And it essentially just kind of really retarded the country for a number of years. And then Ortega finally got elected. Now he has set himself up as president for life. It's a classic kind of gangster presidency,
Joel. Is
that
true? I didn't realize that. Oh, wow.
Oh, it's terrible. I mean, he has...
I mean, is that in the Constitution or there laws or you're just saying...
Well, no, the Constitution, which forbids a president succeeding himself, was changed by Ortega and the legislature, because once he got back into power, I mean, all these opposition people who hated him, he just bought them all. So he's got a unified legislature. No, actually, Joel, a very interesting thing. So what he did was he sued the Constitution of his own country that he helped to write, saying that the clause that said a president can't succeed himself to get rid of presidents for life was a violation of his human rights because it forbade him from being elected if the people wanted him. It was a stupid thing, done in secrecy, done very shady. But once it was over, he has won the second term already, and he will remain president through hook or by crook until he dies in office. And it is a bit of a gangster state as well. I mean, it's not, thank God, like Honduras, Guatemala, or El Salvador, which have been flooded with drugs and drug gangs and the violence that's driving them up to our border. And one of the things, Joel, I was reading, they think helped prevent that was, depending on where you were ideologically, during the Sandinistas' revolution, they had these CDRs, the Committees for the Defense of the Revolution, which were either these KGB-inspired Big Brother local committees that kept an eye on everybody and reported you, which they did, or they were the people who distributed the meager basket of goods that the government would guarantee that everyone will get this, which they also did. But that kind of local government, once the Sandinistas were gone, it remained in some neighborhoods, but it has developed over the years into a kind of community organization / neighborhood watch. And everyone I've read has credited these, the remnants now of the Committees for the Defense of the Revolution, for being able to keep an eye on the neighborhood so that when the narcos show up, they're getting reported right away. When someone shows, like they do in everywhere else in Central America, American gang tattoos, they would be reported right away. Now, and people say this is one of the reasons why Nicaragua has been spared some of the horrendous violence in Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala over these last several years.
And Mexico.
And Mexico as well.
You're listening to the Bread and Roses Show on Valley Free Radio, WXOJ 103.3 FM, streaming at valleyfreeradio.org. I'm Joel Sachs. We're replaying an interview done in August 2014 with Joe Gannon on the publication of his first novel, Night of the Jaguar, a detective mystery set in 1980s Nicaragua. We're replaying the show to celebrate varied awards the book has won in the past year, including most recently second place honors at the International Latino Book Awards in the mystery category, and has been named by the American Library Association's magazine the best mystery debut of 2014. Joe has just finished the second novel in the Ajax Montoya series, The Last Dawn, which will be published this fall. I see you've got the book. Let's go to the book and maybe we can get some poetry in. So what do you have open for us here, Joe?
Well, I thought I was looking for an excerpt, Joel, that really touched on like the politics of it. And this is a scene that I like. And I kind of hope, like, you know, any publicity is good publicity. People familiar with Nicaragua might object politically to one kind of subplot I have in here. I'd like to read you a little excerpt. It's where Ajax is sitting down with the villain in the book, who is, his name is titled Subcomandante Vladimir Malora. He's head of state security. He's the head of the secret police. He's kind of the J. Edgar Hoover of Nicaragua. he and Ajax used to be kind of partners. They were involved in a political assassination that Ajax disagreed with. Anyways, Ajax thinks he has found out that this character of Vladimir Malora has been killing all these people. Turns out he's wrong. But he goes back. He's up in the mountains, up in the war zones, a very dangerous mission. So he returns to Managua intending to arrest this guy, which is kind of like, imagine some, you know, New York homicide cop walking into the FBI headquarters 30 years ago and trying to arrest J. Edgar Hoover, you know, or Beria in Stalin's Russia. So this is the scene between them and what Ajax thinks this whole mystery is all about, but it turns out he's wrong. he makes reference to the conquistadores, that's what he calls just a couple of the Malora's henchmen. Subcomandante Vladimir Malora sat behind a desk not much smaller than Connolly's truck. In his soft, clean hand, he held a cigar not much shorter than the blade strapped to Ajax's leg. His uniform was immaculately pressed, the insignia on it perfectly placed. His boots shone like black mirrors. He barked orders into a phone. Ajax suspected there was no one on the other end. While he waited for Malora's theatrics to conclude, he let himself imagine how the Comandante would look after a week in the same cell as El Gordo Sangroso. He smiled at the thought, which is what he needed to be doing right now, smiling. Malora hung up the phone, took his sweet time lighting his cigar, and then dismissed the conquistadores with a wave. Ajax, would you like a cigar? Cuban? No. How about a Marlboro Red, made in America? No. It's funny, isn't it? The communists make the best cigars and the capitalists the best cigarettes. No. No. It's not funny. The word you're looking for is ironic. Ironic, yes. He rolled the cigar between his fingers. Ajax, why have we never been friends? I don't know. Ajax looked around at the office, Malora's throne room, as if he held the answer. Maybe because you are the kind of man I despise most. You're vain, greedy, and deep down, a coward. Malora smiled and drew deeply on his cigar. There are only a handful of people in this entire country who would dare speak to me that way. If everyone spoke to you that way, you'd be a better person and would have a better country. Malora knocked the head of ash off the cigar into a jade ashtray. Ajax, you've always thought you were special, the great hero. No one can tell you anything, but what are you really? A drunk? A killer? That's right, we know. We've been monitoring Contra radio chatter. You scared them out of their boots. They think you're the angel of death. But what are you really? Ajax took the handcuffs out of his pocket and hung them from his belt. Get to your point. What you are, Ajax, is a child, a Boy Scout. You speak like a Nicaraguan, but you think like an American fool. Malora made six shooters with his hands. Pow, pow, pow. Everything is a cowboy western. White hats and black hats. It's always made you unreliable. That's why there was no place for you after the triumph. You're a liberal bourgeois, not a comrade. Now tell me what you think you know. Malora took another long pull on the cigar. Ajax wandered over to the portrait of Sandino hanging from the wall. It was an excellent oil painting done from the iconic photograph of the diminutive rebel general in his 10-gallon Stetson. Ajax saw it all clearly as when Epimenio told him the men at the airstrip had Cuban accents, just like Marta, but she was Colombian. You're running drugs out of a secret airstrip in the mountains of Matagalpa. Cocaine, probably. Enrique Cuadra came upon it by accident while hunting a jaguar. But the men you use for it are blowhards like you. Can't keep their mouths shut. Don't know about light and noise discipline. Cuadra heard them talking, recognized their accents as Colombians. He put two and two together and decided to do something about it. You found out and killed him before he could tell Matthew Connolly. And what if that's true? So what? Ajax turned from the portrait of the past to face the present. There was a cockiness to Malorder that hinted at a whole card. You murdered a citizen of the Republic, a good man who gave three sons to the revolution. He slid the handcuff off his belts. I'm going to put these on you and take you to jail, or I will kill you where you sit. There's no third option. And then he goes on a little bit. If I could just skip ahead a little bit,
yeah.
Joel, what
yeah.
I want to get to is he finally says, he finally gets down to trying to figure out what Malorder is up to and why. So Vladimir Malorder, so the villain says, we cannot attack the United States from the outside, only from within. Their decadence is our greatest ally. Their love of the coca is an undefended flank we can attack. We can feed the giant poison, Ajax. Right now, there are tens of thousands of Americans going to jail for drugs. In 10 or 15 years, these narcos will have become hardened criminals to be released back into their communities to wreak more havoc. Millions of children born to drug-addicted mothers. Their Negro inner cities are like war zones. The impact on public policy, resources, the very politics of the whole country as we make them fight the war on drugs, which they will lose. The cocaine is a weapon, a bomb we can explode now and again 15 years from now. Do you see? The poor man's weapon of mass destruction. Yes, yes, my God, you do get it. And he goes on to talk about this notion of cocaine as the poor man's weapons of mass destruction. It's folly. But Malorder raises a point that I have some sympathy for, that American foreign policy has created these nightmarish conditions. I mean, going back to when they originally invaded Nicaragua in the 20s, or Guatemala, or Vietnam, or then what they did to Nicaragua through the Contras, and then right up to
Iraq,
and on to Iraq.
And
then nothing ever happens. We simply walk away, and as he says, the bad guy says later on, lament we couldn't have done more, but then we just go pull the wings off of some other fly. This is a guy who has said, I want revenge. I will revenge myself for this. And he does it by, for him, it's like, you know, what do Americans love? They love drugs, so we just feed it to them. But this is not somebody who looks and says, well, there are rich Americans, or there are rich white Americans, or there are poor Americans, or there are black Americans. For him, it don't matter, which is how we are often seen, I think. 9/11, I think, was an attack against all Americans, in the sense that people don't really want to hear, well, I didn't vote for George Bush, and I didn't believe in the war, and people don't really want to hear that. I don't work on Wall Street. There is, outside of this country, a way of seeing the country as one country and the people as one people. And that notion of the poor man's weapons of mass destruction is, and it's a controversial statement to make, but it is how some people tried to explain, you know, the use of jets into the World Towers, the beheading of this poor guy, John Foley, the other day. None of it justifies it. This journalist was held in Syria, was executed. They made a video about and cut his head off.
It's a huge ransom they were demanding.
Oh.
Right.
ISIS, the Iraqi Islamic State.
So that notion, though, that when you are that outgunned, you will do anything to balance it out. And, you know, because there was cocaine involved, but it was mostly the Contra operation, the Contra side of it, smuggling something like planes, arms into Ilopango and San Salvador, drugs out, the same thing in Honduras or Costa Rica. People tried to taint the Sandinistas as a narco state, which they never were. I mean, you can say a lot of things about them, but that's not one. But that notion of using anything, any way of getting back, of stabbing at your enemy in any way. The problem, of course, is the villain is so focused on this, he bumps off any number of Nicaraguan pawns in this great chess game he's got going on.
We're here with Joe Gannon and Val on the Bread and Roses show, talking about Joe's new debut book, and Night of the Jaguar, which you can order on Amazon or get at Broadside Books, Main Street, Northampton, and
do it now.
Do it now. Yeah, get the sales
now.
Going.
Thank you, honey.
Yeah, yeah. We have about 7 minutes left, Joe, and again, there's so many directions we could go. I mean, we won't get into it today, but the question of what's happening in Brazil. I mean, the changes since the Allende regime's overthrow and in Argentina and Chile, the student movement, we have this whole new populist force that's pulsing in Latin America right now. In Uruguay, you know, the president, an old one of the leaders of the mm-hmm. of the military, the underground right. revolutionary movement, is
the
now
Montenegro's.
I mean, he's the president, and has he's unique in the way that he's held to those principles. I don't know much about Uruguay, a little bit, but anyway, so that could be another show of just what we've seen in terms of the shift that's gone on, and what does that say about U.S. foreign policy? And you know, Lula, we're having another election now in Brazil. And there's an interesting contestation going on. There's another Green Party. She's taken the mantle of the Green Party and is getting significant support and could be the new president down there. But you brought in poetry. You brought in poetry, and I wondered if you wanted to.
The protagonist Ajax is kind of a poetry spouting cop. The thing is, for him, you see, he grew up in really in Los Angeles. He was conceived in Nicaragua, but his mother and father had to flee. They were involved in their own insurrection against Somoza. So he is conceived in Nicaragua, raised in the United States. So he gets this very Nicaraguan education. His father is an academic in Managua, but he's a gardener up in... So this, I thought, because this comes up, I think you would appreciate it too, Joe. I want to.
Is this
to pick
in Spanish?
It. No, this is in English. It's by Rubén Darío, the great immortal poet of Nicaragua, probably one of the major poets of the Spanish language in from any country in the 20th century. And it's a poem called "To Roosevelt," and I use it in the book where Ajax has a love affair with this gringa. It's not very long. This journalist, she's down there with these senators who are on a fact-finding mission, and she's an aide to one of them, and she and Ajax fall in love, actually. So they're having, a rather steamy love scene, they kind of have a little debate, a little political fight. And anyways, Ajax makes reference to this poem by Rubén Darío, and it's written to Roosevelt, and this is actually to Teddy Roosevelt, mind you. "To Roosevelt" by Rubén Darío. The voice that would reach you, Hunter, must speak in biblical tones or in the poetry of Walt Whitman. You are primitive and modern, simple and complex. You are one part George Washington and one part Nimrod. You are the United States, future invader of our native America with its Indian blood, an America that still prays to Christ and still speaks Spanish. You are a strong, proud model of your race. You are cultured and able. You oppose Tolstoy. You are an Alexander, Nebuchadnezzar, breaking horses and murdering tigers. You are a professor of energy, as the current lunatics say. You think that life is a fire, that progress is an eruption, that the future is wherever your bullet strikes. No. The United States is grand and powerful. Whenever it trembles, a profound shudder runs down the enormous backbone of the Andes. If it shouts, the sound is like the roar of a lion. And Hugo said to Grant, "The stars are yours. The dawning sun of the Argentine barely shines. The star of Chile is rising. A wealthy country joining the cult of Mammon to the cult of Hercules, while liberty, lighting the path to easy conquest, raises her torch in New York." And I like that because as he says to this, Ajax says to this gringa character, this American woman, you know, you only, the Statue of Liberty is for the huddled masses only if you're standing inside America. On the outside, she holds the torch to light the way for all these Marines going around the world.
You've been listening to the Bread and Roses Show on Valley Free Radio, WXOJ 103.3 FM. I'm Joel Sachs. We've replayed an interview done in August 2014 with Joe Gannon on the publication of his first novel, Night of the Jaguar, a detective mystery set in 1980s Nicaragua. We brought the show out of the archives to celebrate varied awards the book has won in the past year, including second place honors at the International Latino Book Awards. As Joe has just finished the second novel in the Ajax Montoya series, this one named The Last Dawn, to be published this fall by St. Martin's Press, be on the lookout for book readings to hear the newest turns in this evolving saga charting the personal and political challenges of war-scarred 1980s Central America.
To hear this show and other Bread and Roses shows, visit our blog at breadandrosesradio.wordpress.com. That's one word, breadandrosesradio.wordpress.com.